Mouthfeel. I first became besotted with mouthfeel, sitting to the right of my grandmother at Sunday lunches. The main course typically consisted of beef tenderloin cooked to a perfect dusty rose hue, accompanied by roasted potatoes whose shiny and auburn surface gave way with a gentle crackle to the tender middle. But the star of the meal was always the dessert. My grandmother would give me the initials and let me guess. H.M., honey mousse, was the best. Even now, looking back some 50 years, I honestly believe I can isolate the very moment that honey mousse hit my tongue. There were no other senses involved. After all, honey mousse was odorless, and the visual was not compelling. A scoop the color of old dishwater quivered on my plate. Nostalgia for the total experience was not something a 10-year-old could appreciate. Sunday lunches at a formal dining room table with aunts, uncles, and cousins were just part of the routine. I was certainly unaware that I was witnessing a rapidly vanishing lifestyle, one that included Mar, the cook in the kitchen, and Mrs. Dixon, the waitress in the pantry. It wasn't until years later that I realized a secret buzzer beneath the rug was responsible for the impeccable timing of the courses as Mrs. Dixon emerged from the pantry with platters of food. Honey mousse was a pure mouthfeel experience. The sweet molecules just plumped into beckoning taste buds, and any overflow had the equally important job of cloaking the roof of my mouth, my hard palate, with the smooth but slightly grainy softness of a sheet with a low thread count. Dear sweet honey mousse did not overstay its welcome. There was no cloying smear of an aftertaste. It was there and then gone, and I could start fresh with the next spoonful. I had a glorious 4 or 5 year run with honey mousse until my grandparents died and we moved on to the next iteration of family gatherings. Sunday lunches transitioned to a fully loaded sandwich bar in my parents' kitchen. We ate standing up at the counter, wearing wet bathing suits that dripped on the floor, and rummaged for dessert in the huge mudroom freezer that my mother kept fully stocked with popsicles and ice cream bars. Honey mousse vanished from my life. My mother never attempted to make it because she was unnerved by the vagaries of gelatin. She liked to tell the story of an attempt at a tomato aspic, and how she overshot the gelatin and ended up with an inedible rubberized tomato concoction that could bounce on the floor. Jello desserts in overly bright carnival colors were the only gelatin that she allowed in the house. However, I do credit honey mousse as the gateway to more accessible mouthfeel desserts, such as pudding and ice cream. My grandmother also served homemade strawberry ice cream flecked with seeds and nuggets of strawberry pulp. Another favorite was small Pyrex dishes filled with white rennet custard adorned with chocolate shavings the size and shape of commas. These desserts made me realize that mouthfeel did not need to be limited to the unalloyed creaminess of honey mousse, but could accommodate carefully titrated textural variety. Nuts or raisins in ice cream destroy the optimal balance for their chewiness or crunchiness. Small pearl tapioca presents a pleasing mouthfeel, but the large pearl variety, well, I'm sorry, these pearls are just too brazen. The overall visual reminds me of knobby loogies suspended in a tenacious sea of phlegm. My most enduring relationship with mouthfeel desserts has been chocolate chip ice cream. As long as the chips meet my exacting specifications of the right size, quality, quantity, and dispersal in the ice cream, small enough so that they don't require a separate chewing motion. The best chocolate provides a soft, giving crunch as the ice cream is pressed against the palate. This noise must be consistent throughout the serving, thus requiring even dispersal of the chocolate. Chips must be high-quality, semi-sweet chocolate. Fake chocolate is abhorrent. For those of you on the East Coast, I'm sorry to report that the chips in Friendly's ice cream are too large and poorly distributed. Based on my vast experience, Baskin and Robbins chocolate chip ice cream meets all of the specifications. Even though I substituted other desserts over the years, the memory of honey mousse has always held a ground zero soft spot in my heart. As my grandmother's 110th birthday approached, I decided to revive honey mousse and take my chances with gelatin. The cookbook, Have Fun with Herbs, was self-published by my grandmother in the late 1950s, and here I found my recipe. I thought it would be a fitting family unity exercise to dedicate a weekend when all of us, now sprinkled across the country, would concoct one of the recipes in the cookbook and then share our experiences in remembrance of my grandparents and our Sunday lunches. As I perused the book, I realized that while being a cherished family item, Have Fun with Herbs was seriously flawed. There are many instances where the temperature of the oven was omitted, and that maddening phrase, cook until done, appeared frequently. The cookbook's dated quality was charming. Many recipes focused on the novelty of frozen vegetables and processed foods. For example, the recipe for string beans and mushrooms called for a package of bird's-eye French-style frozen beans and a can of mushroom soup. Other expressions included eggs that were high and scarce, presumably describing the high price and scarcity of eggs during World War II, or an egg of butter, referring to the estimated quantity of butter in the era before quarter-pound sticks were wrapped with conveniently marked tablespoons. My cousin Susie thought that the theme of the recipes was to add wine early and often, while I detected that many of the recipes included the unhealthy trio of butter, cream, and eggs. I was hosting a smattering of local relatives, and in addition to the mousse, had considered a variety of unique items from the cookbook to round out our memorial meal. A buffet of tripe and tongue seemed to fit the bill, but this menu was greeted with outright hostility by the senior members of the group. When asked which he preferred, Uncle Frank said that he would prefer not to come, and my father begged to have something different. I got the message and was secretly relieved, since the recipes required me to skin the tongue and wash the tripe. I had no experience with a tongue, but skinning it sounded like something a cannibal might do. And based on my experience as a pathologist doing autopsies, I knew there was no way I could ever clean tripe to an edible level. I settled on a squash lasagna that my nephew had made and positioned honey mousse as a nostalgic showpiece. The recipe was consistent with the overall unhealthy pattern of the cookbook, consisting only of honey, eggs, and cream, all held together with the intimidating gelatin. I'm not much of a cook, but if I had to self-classify, I would say that I'm more instinctual than technical, often concluding that a recipe just can't be correct. Honey mousse was no exception. I made the executive decision that the amount of cream in the recipe was way too heavy-handed. So based on Susie's observation, I substituted a cup of sherry for 1 cup of cream. Then the recipe called for placing the sweet, creamy concoction in a mold, and I found just the thing. The previous Christmas, I received a catalog from the Anatomical Supply Company, which primarily sold instructional posters and models of body parts, i.e. the circulatory system or the ankle, for doctor's offices. But they also sold molds of body parts as a novelty, and I purchased molds of the heart, the left hand, and a brain. Bloop, 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 I poured the honey mousse into the brain and let it set. I searched through my parents' house in an effort to duplicate my grandmother's table. I found long unused gold filigreed finger bowls and set them on delicate lace doilies in front of each person's plate. I retrieved the cut crystal glasses adorned with little star shapes that left imprints on my fingertips. My dining room table seemed cramped compared to my grandparents' expansive table. As a 10-year-old, it seemed to stretch on forever, so far that I imagined my natty grandfather shrouded in wispy mist at the other end. 50 years later, one complete generation was gone, and most of the next. But when I did a head count, I realized that I had a similar number of relatives at this gathering. My elderly Uncle Frank, who had always talked business with his father at the remote end of the table, now looked exactly like my grandfather as I remembered him. 2 young nieces and nephews subbed in for my generation. 2 brothers and I assumed our parents' niche. I was still worried about over-gelatinizing, but when I peeked in at the mold, I was pleased to see a satisfactory consistency and wondered what had so flustered my mother. The next challenge was to get the mousse out of the mold in 1 piece. My young niece Della and I went into the kitchen and jiggled the thing and then used a little knife around the edges. Holding our breath, we tipped the mold. With a sucking whoosh noise, the brain plopped on the plate in 1 glorious and glistening piece. The Anatomical Supply Company had helpfully provided recipes and suggested that watermelon jello would produce a most lifelike brain. They obviously never considered the attributes of autopsy-perfect honey mousse. The pallid, grayish brain shimmied and shimmered on the plate. If this mousse was any brainier, it would have been Einstein's. We gave Uncle Frank the honors of serving dessert, and told him that since he rejected other organ meats for the entrees, we had found a suitable substitute for dessert. The poor man was initially panic-stricken at the sight of the lifelike human brain, but then erupted in peals of laughter. I took a nibble from the frontal lobes. The sweetness of the honey and sherry combined with the alcohol packed a wallop. My taste buds rose up in grateful awe as the comforting texture blossomed in my mouth. Far from the isolated memory of a 10-year-old with no sense of time and place, the honey mousse transported me to full-on nostalgia. The dining room table suddenly seemed to stretch on forever. I noticed the same starry imprint on my fingertips as I gripped my glass. My brother was attempting to make bread from my grandmother's vague recipe. The dough never rose, but its earthy smell seeped in from the adjacent kitchen. Another brother brought the signature after-eight dinner mints that my grandmother always had on the sideboard. I leaned over and whispered, H.M., to my startled niece, who was still distracted by the brain rather than the glories of mouthfeel. After a few bites, we agreed that from a taste perspective, the mousse was not a success. Our group of 12 barely made a dent in the frontal lobes, and I've never made it again. But honey mousse was a complete success in a more important realm, transcending beyond simple mouthfeel to a complete sensory and emotional memory, the invisible thread that connects me to my past. Mentally, I can just pluck that thread, and suddenly it is Sunday. I'm 10 and eating lunch next to my grandmother.